Hey, welcome to Subscription Heroes. I'm your host, Scott Herf, co-founder and chief product officer of Churnkey. Now, it's not every day you get to chat with a legitimate legend, and that's why I'm thrilled to share my conversation with Jason Fried. He's the co-founder and CEO of 37 Signals, makers of Basecamp and Hey, and he's also a best-selling author of 4 books about work, design, and building calm companies. So enjoy my chat with Jason. We start things off by talking about his recent sabbatical. So Jason, you're coming off a 4-week sabbatical, first in a long time. Now that you're back in the mix, what's been most on your mind lately?
Well, it's been good to know that the company can run without me. Not that I imagined it couldn't, but it's confidence inspiring to know that, you know, you built a great team, you've got a great company, things can run. So that's not like on my mind, but it was a wonderful realization to come back to going, hey, things are great. Things are fine here.
Right.
I'm not essential. Just like no one really is, but it's nice. So there's that. And then I'm also, you know, whenever you come back from a break, you just see things through fresh eyes. And I see some of our messaging is a bit, you know, even messaging that I wrote, it feels a bit dull. Like I want to kind of get back and sharpen some things up. So you kind of need to step away from some things to come to see them fresh again. And so I feel like I've spotted a few things that are on my mind that I want to tighten up. So it's good. And there's no way to really notice that stuff, I think, unless you're away from it.
Right. I know you said you just did a lot of nothing, which sounds incredible, by the way. But you get any like biographies, watch anything inspiring to, you know, kind of bring that energy? Or was it just separation, family, all that?
Yeah, I read a couple books that are just not business related at all, which I typically don't read business books anyway. Mostly what I did was I went on a lot of long walks and I just didn't think of anything intentionally. You know,
right.
I had set out or initially go, okay, I've got 6-7 weeks here. I'm going to like, I've wanted to learn drums for a while. So I was going to take some drum lessons. I was going to learn some Spanish. I had all these things I wanted to do. And then I realized like, that's just work also. Like I actually don't want to work on anything, you know, for a bit. So
right.
After I got over the things I wanted to do, I just realized, how about what if I have nothing to do and nothing intentional to deal with, and besides family and the things that I have to deal with no matter what. And it was just really nice, literally just to walk around, just to be and not really have anything on my mind that was important. And then if I came across something I wanted to check out or read or see or whatever, I would do that. I also went on some longer drives. I like driving and I haven't driven cars in a while. Like I haven't really had the time to go out and drive, you know,
right.
Like
I know
you wake up, you got your kids, you take them to school, you got work, you get back, you got dinner, it's dark. So being able to go on some drives and not feel like I have this schedule thing that's coming down on me in 35 minutes, it was actually quite nice as well.
It's freedom. It's like, you know, it sounds great to learn Spanish or something, but then it's just a hassle. And then you're going to cram it into 4 weeks, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I want to learn. I really want to get back.
Right.
I know a little bit. I want to get back into it. I think what I realized was trading one scheduled work thing, which is work, for another one, wouldn't have been a break, actually. So I wanted to just really, truly take a break. I think I'm so used to filling my time with things to do that it was nice to literally have nothing to fill my time with other than things that just came up out of nowhere, basically. That's what I realized I needed after a week or two in of like trying to fill my days. So what's interesting too is I kind of realized like when you take a break like this, maybe other people are good at this. I haven't been because I haven't done it before. There's just it comes in stages. You've got like some, you're like, oh, I have nothing, no work this week. But then you just find stuff to keep you busy because that's what you've been doing for 20 years. My momentum is just carrying me into doing things. So it took me a week or two to kind of come down from that. And then it was really pleasant actually.
Amazing. I was thinking the other day about freedom and leisure and I remember you used to be a watch collector. I don't know if you still are, but I was thinking back. Awesome. So I can't wait to ask you about this because I've gotten the bug too.
Okay.
You had one of the best watch Instagrams, like 2016, 2017. I still think about that feed. That was just incredible. So I do miss that. But what are you into now? Along and so on, I still catch your eye? Or
yeah, I still love watches. You know, the Instagram thing was interesting because I found myself getting carried away with showing things off, essentially, which is like,
yeah.
It's not my style to do that. But Instagram kind of happened that way. Like you buy something and it's like, I want to, whatever I collect or whatever, I want it to be for me, not for other people. And I found myself slightly doing things for others on that. So I said, I'm not going to do that anymore, but I still kept collecting stuff, but it did change my behavior, which was a good confirmation that social pressure, and essentially it's peer pressure in many ways with like thousands or 10,000 people you don't know, which is not really a healthy thing, encouraging you to do certain things versus you just doing them for yourself. So I slowed down my collecting in a sense, but actually tightened it up and focused just on stuff I like. So Longa, I like a lot. I like Speedmasters a lot. I went through a bunch of vintage Rolex stuff and I still have some, but I dialed some of that back. I got into some modern stuff. I tried some different brands. I tried some different things. And I've kind of tightened my collection up. It's still like too much. I have like 25 watches. It's still too many watches. Yeah. But, you know, I'm down from like 40 or something, wherever I was. I'm finding that like if I don't wear something, you know, within 3 months or something, then I should just probably get rid of it, unless it's something that's very special that I right. just really want to have forever.
Vote with your wrist.
Vote with your wrist. Yeah, basically. But I'm you know, it's Watches and Wonders week right now, and I'm sort of watching. I don't know if you're familiar with that show, but that's sort of like the big annual show. Well, not it's one of the big annual shows that's going on right now in Geneva. I'm not there.
Oh, no,
I've never been. But I'm following from afar, you know, watching all the watch sites and seeing the new releases and stuff. So I do enjoy that part of it still. But and I miss a bit of the community on Instagram around that. But I don't know. It was the trade-offs weren't worth it. I didn't like having to feel like I had to do things to show others or whatever it was.
Right. And if there's ever, if you ever put something up to the group, it's like, should I go for this watch or whatever? It's like, they will always say yes.
Of course.
Because they want to live through you, right?
Enablers.
Yes.
We're all enablers. We're all enablers. The other thing that kind of got weird about it was that some of these things can be quite expensive. And, yeah. you know, I really like these things and it's something I've worked hard for, but people start to get the wrong idea. And so it's just a good idea. Right. I don't need to share these things and it's not something I need to make public.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I also got the Speedmaster bug. This is one my wife got for me when
nice.
We got married. It's it's a 1970, the transitional case back. So it's still the straight case back writing.
Yep, yep.
Which I think is cool.
Yep. So 1970, so it's like a, what's the reference? You know, is it 145? No, it'd be, yeah, maybe 145022 or something. Is that?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, nice. Those are cool. Yeah.
Very
cool. It's cool. That's a good old one. That's a nice one.
Yeah. And it's nice, like, you know, it only happened for a couple of years, so it's interesting. You know,
yeah.
It's not the typical stuff on the back, you know, so.
Right. Yeah, today I've got an IWC. I got this IWC last year.
Oh, cool.
This is the tribute. It's called the Tribute to 3705. So back in the 90s, they released what was called the 3705, which was this chronograph that was really, it kind of looked like this. This is the modern one, so they upsized it a little bit to 41, but the original one was 39, but it's made of ceramic. Or I forget what they call it. They've got some fancy name because it's
bio-ceramic or something.
Yeah, it's like ceramic and titanium, ceratanium or something. I don't know what they call it. But anyway.
That sounds fancier.
It's cool. I've really come to like this watch too. And I'm kind of getting into slightly bigger watches. I used to be into smaller watches, so a little bit bigger now. But I don't know. It's kind of fun. It's still a fun hobby. I still like mixing it up.
Totally. Yeah, I've got...
What else do you
have?
I
was just wearing last night a World War II era A11, which is... like 19 millimeters, tiny, you know,
oh,
and these
wow.
things used to be tiny. So it's kind of
that?
Fun.
Was it some unknown
it
brand?
It was Elgin, maybe Hamilton.
Oh, cool. American. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So fun American, you know, service member watch. But, you know, you mentioned IWC and Long A. They made the Fleeger watch for,
yes.
You know, the pilots. And that's one of my dream watches, but the whole like radium loom thing kind of turns me off.
Yeah. It's funny.
I guess you could restore it, but...
Yeah, yeah, but then you kind of lose it. It's funny, I was just talking like an hour ago to this watch dealer. I was looking at this old Submariner from the early 60s. I asked him to put a Geiger on it because it's sort of in the period where it might be tritium or it might be radium, and it was still radium, and I'm like, I'm not interested. I just don't want... There's no reason, in my opinion, to have this radioactive thing on your wrist. There's
right.
so many watches that don't have that, so I stay away from anything with radium on it, and especially those old pilot's watches that have tons of radium. I mean, massive amounts of radium paint on those things. So it's probably a good idea to stay away from that.
Yeah. Strapping something radioactive on my wrist never really, it was on my bucket list. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's take a little break to tell you about Chernky, the ones making this podcast happen. Now, I think Chernky is awesome, but I am super biased because I'm a co-founder. But I love what we're doing for subscription companies. you might look at your churn numbers and think there's got to be a way to turn this around. There's got to be someone who can improve retention and help us track down why people are leaving your product. And that's why ChurnKey's here. ChurnKey's the only platform that fixes every type of churn for you. We handle retention for customer-obsessed teams like Jasper, Fairdrop, AI Dungeon, and Castos. We lower cancellations by up to 42%, recover up to 89% of failed payments, and even increase customer LTV by 28%. And we do it with our user-friendly, customer-centric cancel flows, modern failed payment recovery, and AI-driven feedback analysis. So, if you want to run a healthier subscription business, head to churnkey.co to get started. Well, I want to switch to writing. I mean, and you mentioned tuning up some messaging that you saw coming back, and it impresses me how much you still write. I mean, you write a lot, and I want to know, do you ever just write for yourself, or is it mostly an audience of one, and that's how it's always been, right? You're writing for your own satisfaction.
I write what I'd want to read, basically.
Yeah.
I have to write something that I wish existed, essentially. And I don't write as a hobby. So I wouldn't like be someone to write a novel or short stories. That's not really my thing, but I just like to kind of share my point of view through writing. And I've always just written about what's been on my mind and tried to be direct and conversational about it. And some of the things I write, it could be, you know, 6-7 paragraphs. It could take 5 minutes. Sometimes it can take an hour. Sometimes it could take a week of thinking about it and putting it down. It just sort of depends. I think the best things, though, are usually the things that kind of just flow out and you're just like, you're done. There's no drafts. It's just like, I mean, you might spell check or whatever, but yeah. You just kind of get it out there and you move on as if we're having a conversation. But I think the most important thing I found for reading is to write something that you'd want to read and not to write for anyone else. Write for you. Otherwise, I think you're just beginning to imagine what other people want. And I don't think any of us are very good at really figuring that out. I mean, there's formulas and there's all sorts of things you can do, I'm sure, to increase SEO and all that stuff. There's like those tricks. But as far as pure writing goes and sharing ideas, just share the ideas that you wish you'd heard or you wish you'd read. That's enough. That's a strategy I've followed. And I think David's the same way. And I think it served us well. So that's at least our point of view on it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not a one and done, what's the process like? Do you kick it over to David or do you have some friends?
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes if there's something that's like, there's a page on Basecamp. If you go to basecamp.com/small. So I wrote this earlier this year, and this is like a public marketing page around, you know, focused on small businesses, why we're fans of small businesses and don't really care about big ones. This is a piece on our website that's like a part of the site that's a strong message. And I did toss this one back and forth with David. So things that are kind of permanent like that, I'll often show someone else, get someone's feedback on that sort of thing. But like post to my Hey World blog or things on Twitter or things I used to write on Medium or our blog Signal versus Noise over the years, that's just extemporaneous writing. Very, very rarely would I share that with anyone ahead of time. I don't think it's precious. I don't think it needs to be shared. It's just like, here's my thought. Yeah. Like, this is my thought. Here it is. But if we're going to write something that's going to stay in place on a site or have a really strong point of view, I'll often run it by somebody. But it's not, there's no, so the other thing is I don't write on a schedule. So there's not like every week I got to produce two or three things. Like sometimes I'll go for weeks without writing anything. Other times I'll write a few things. I've got like three topics on my mind I would love to write about this week if I get a chance to. If I don't get a chance to, I'll do it the following week. Or I will fall out of love with the ideas and they just won't ever get written. So that can happen too. So I have a very short list of things I'm thinking about that I might want to share. One of them is, I'll just tell you ahead of time because maybe it'll encourage me to write it. It's about performance reviews. People will always ask me about them. Like, how do you guys do them and how often you do them? And how do you decide if someone sort of makes the cut after a certain period of time? You know, because when you hire someone, you don't really know if they're going to work out. You hope they will. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't. How do you know? For me, it always comes down to this one question, which is, let's call it a year in. Usually give people about a year to sort of find their way. Sometimes less, sometimes a little bit more, but around that amount of time. You can do performance reviews. You can look at all sorts of metrics. You can do all those things. You can also just ask yourself one question that answers all of them. And this is what the piece is going to be about, which is, would I hire this person again? So I feel like a year in, what you're doing is you're rehiring that person. Would you rehire that person? And would they rehire the job? Are they happy they made the choice to come here? That sort of thing. So I like finding these things that sort of answer a bunch of different questions. And to me, that's sort of one of the things. So I want to write about that. I've never written about it. I want to write about that. So maybe I'll do it this week. Maybe I won't. And maybe I just won't find enough to say. That's the other thing that happens sometimes. Like maybe I have a paragraph on that or two and like I don't have much more to say. And I'm like, is it really worth writing that up? So in that case, I'll probably just like write it up on LinkedIn as like a comment or something or a thought versus like thinking about it as a post. But anyway, there's no formula. It's just kind of what flows through the fingers, you know? Do I have enough there? And that's how that goes.
So you got Hey World, you got LinkedIn, Twitter. And there was a time when you wrote just every piece of copy. And I could tell that it was you, you know?
Yeah, I still do
letters
that.
And all that. You still do everything.
I still write all of our marketing sites, all the key pages.
Yeah.
So there's some pages on Basecamp.com that I haven't written. And some stuff was changed on the homepage while I was out. So some of that isn't mine, but the majority of everything that's, let's call it the top five pages on the site or something like that, you know, the landing page, the pricing page, maybe the something about features or how it works, that kind of stuff. That's me. That's actually the thing I enjoy doing most, frankly, is, well, two things. I like coming up with new ideas and building new products. And then I love figuring out a way to talk about them and trying to connect with people who are shopping for them, basically. So that I do really like. So I still do that. That's my primary, I would say my primary contribution these days. I've been designing conceptually new products and features and whatnot, but I haven't been in the HTML and CSS doing that work anymore, but I still do a lot of the writing on the sites. Yep.
And let's talk about like UI in that sense. I mean, that can still originate, you know, a feature idea or something, that can still originate with copy, and I'm sure it does. Or is it just you saying to Jason, hey, you know, can you work on this? I had this idea for this thing in Hey.
You mean where a feature comes from, or what do you mean?
Yeah. So in terms of, I know you used to write out the UI first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, are you still doing that as the zero point, or is it more of the pitch that's taking place of that? Or
yeah. Or so the pitch is always written. It's never performed. So it's not like there's a meeting where I explain it. It's always written down. It's written down maybe sometimes with a few sketches to support the writing to like explain something visually, like this is what I'm trying to say or how I think it could look. But everything always starts with writing. And the idea, the feature itself, a big part of it is like, how would we write the screens? Like, how would we explain what this is? And then the pitch is written, you know, a handful of paragraphs and a sketch or two. Sometimes we'll write, actually like design the UI in words first, in a sense. It depends on the feature. Some features are more conducive to doing it that way. Others really need to be drawn out.
Yeah.
It just depends on the feature, but it's always described in words. It shouldn't require anyone to have to re-explain or to explain in a different way. So if we can't get clear enough, then the feature probably isn't ready. It's kind of how I tend to think about it. Yeah.
Right. That to me is one of the, I mean, it's a staple of your products, and it kind of feels like that is one of many reasons for your staying power. I mean, you started out going up against Microsoft Project, and now it's, you know, name your VC-backed opponent, Asana, ClickUp, losing hundreds of millions of dollars. For them, it's okay. But, you know, you're still there. You're still delivering. I want to ask about, like, your playbook for staying relevant, evolving. Do you think it's your consistency and authenticity that make you stand out and grow? Or is it something else? Because it's 24 years, you know?
Yeah, almost 24 years. So one thing is I don't know, but I have a few ideas. Number one is we've always run a profitable business. So staying power, like at the most fundamental level, means like, do you make more money than you spend so you can pay your bills? Like it really—
Imagine that.
Yeah, it's sort of silly even talk about it, but in our industry, of course, it's unusual. And so that's where staying power has to start. You can will yourself into existence for as long as you want, but like reality is always going to come and get you. And if you can't stay in business, fundamental business, then you're out. So part of this is always trying to run a profitable business, which means keeping our headcount small, keeping our costs low, charging money for our products, not giving them away for free, and figuring out how to make money later. And then delivering a really high level of service, delivering unique products with a unique point of view, and also marrying those with a perspective and a philosophy that's tied into all of it. So it's, you know, if you use Basecamp or use Hey, you're to some degree, you're buying into a certain philosophy of working. you can still use it in your own way and do it your own thing. But if you want to sort of swim with the current when you're using these products, you kind of, it's nice to sort of have a sense of where you're headed and why you're headed in that direction, why things work the way they work. So I think, and then there's the sort of prolific sharing we've always been doing for many, many years. So we share without expectation of return, write books, write blog posts, do podcasts, share our insights, share design reviews, share code reviews, share as much as we can to show people how a business is run and how we run ours. And then try to be as transparent as we can all the way through and try to be as honest as we can all the way through and price things fairly and you know, all those things. I don't know which parts of those are the fundamentally most important parts, but I think it's a combination of all those things. But fundamentally, got to run a sound business. You've got to make good products. You've got to treat customers well. You've got to treat employees well. I think you have to probably have a unique point of view to last. And we also aren't beholden to any outside powers that want us to go away. I mean, like if you raise money, they basically want you to kind of go away at some point because you need to exit, you know, or merge or go public, which changes your company. So we're in it. Like we start our business, stay in business, not to go out of business. And I think that also that mindset's important. Like we want to be here for the long term. We've been here for almost 25 years. Can we be here for another 10, 15, 20? Maybe, hopefully. Like I don't know. But the mindset is we're here to stick around. We're not here to leave. And I think that is really important. I think if you go into business thinking about how you're going to get out of it, you always have that on your back or on your shoulders. Yeah. Like, maybe we don't need to work on this because who cares? In 3 years, we're going to be gone anyway, or that sort of thing.
And I think it makes you kind of be hypersensitive to trends and, you know, you chase them because you want to ride the hype train to something immediate, right? Or in the short term, which you guys don't do. It does make me ask though, I mean, the AI stuff, I don't know, everyone's talking about it. It's so trendy, but I know you've said in the past that computers will eventually program themselves.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any way you all embrace AI?
Yeah, so this is obviously like a real thing that's happening and a real shift. I think the real power of it at the moment is in providing certain insights that you might not have, refining certain things that you've perhaps put together, summarizing things. I think right now it's a bit novel, and novel in terms of new, but maybe it's a bit of a novelty as well. I don't think we're quite sure what's going on with it yet, like where it's going to go. And I also think that at some point there's going to have to be a splintering of voices in it, because if everyone's using the same thing, which is essentially ChatGPT, let's just call it that for the moment, just on the tech side, ChatGPT has a voice. I know it can write in the style of other people sort of, but it still has this thing like, you can kind of tell, in a sense, sort of where it came from. And so I think what's going to be really interesting about AI eventually is more on the personal side of things. Like if you had a personal assistant, truly, that like Siri was supposed to be sort of, but not really. But someone who really understood, or someone or something, I should say, who really understood your style, how would you respond to this? How would you write about this? How would you react to this? Would you ignore this? Would you engage with this? I think once something can really, where you feel like you have a second brain or like a second pair of hands that are yours, I think then it becomes very, very, very interesting and very, very useful, because then it can really like do things for you in your own style, in your own way. Until then, it's interesting, but it's fascinating. But I don't know how we would use it quite yet. So we're going to kind of, you know, watch. We're clearly watching right now.
Yeah.
I think the summarization stuff's pretty interesting though, like summarize this thing. But the thing is, the way we work is we don't write long, super long documents that need to be summarized. We don't have 90-minute meetings that need to be summarized. We don't have long transcripts that need to be abridged or something like that. So it doesn't really lend itself to the way we work currently, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I can see how, you know, people are adopting it. It makes a lot of sense, especially in big corporate environments where there's a lot of stuff going around that people don't have a chance to read.
Right.
I think Midjourney though, frankly, like Midjourney is more interesting to me. The visual side of it's really fast. I just find that to be more amazing than the text side of it currently. I know ChatGPT-4 can look at images and divine meaning from that, but actually to produce the kind of stuff that Midjourney produces, that to me is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I produced a series of paintings, we'll call it, with Midjourney, where it was Nighthawks, you know, the painting, the diner painting. at night, but replaced by robots. And the output was just hilarious, but also just beautiful, you know? And I wonder, you know, there's going to be a time when our kids, that's all they know, right? They can just think about an image and output it. I mean, are you talking to your kids about AI yet? Are they aware old enough for that stuff yet?
So my son, who's 8, he and I have played with this stuff a bit. Played with ChatGPT a bit, played with DALL-E more than Midjourney at the moment. But yeah, I think the thing that's exciting to me about it is that it's like with Midjourney specifically, because I think it's such a level up from DALL-E or whatever that's called, is that writers can be painters now. And I could never paint. I could never really draw. I used to be able to draw a little bit. I can like draw interfaces and stuff, but like actually drawing figures or whatever. And it's always been frustrating to me to not be able to do that, or to have an idea for something like a piece of furniture or an object or a building or a room or a layout or something. And I can't just, like, my wife is a really talented artist and she can like just draw. And I'm just so jealous because I don't know how to do that. And I should probably practice and learn a bit, but it's also just exciting to know, like, I can write and describe things really well. So now I can also paint in a sense, or I can draw in a sense. And why wouldn't we want to do that? Like, if you and I could communicate without talking, we can just telepathically communicate, right? Let's say, that might be a level up too. And then you could go, well, what about language? Well, language is important too, but if we could directly communicate, and that's kind of what this sort of is to me in a sense. It's like, I can't draw. I'm jumping over the drawing skill part and I'm able to paint with words. I think that's great. I think our kids, I mean, right, this is so nascent right now. Like, what we're seeing is nothing, you know? Yeah. So 5 years from now, even 3 years from now, I mean, you can see how quickly Midjourney and ChatGPT have gotten better in like a year and a half or a year. So it's just going to be mind-blowing. And then you can imagine the next thing would be, I would imagine, video, you know? Make a 3-minute video of birds flying and, you know, blah, blah, whatever you come up with, right? And then it's like a video is produced. And then you're talking about making movies by describing them, you know? It's going to be incredible. And then sound. There's already like AI for sound. Like, make a song that sounds like this. Or I saw something recently, maybe this has been out for a while, but there's an AI that will make music based on a video that you give it. And then it's like, we made a 1-minute commercial or demo, like put music to it that sounds like this. And here are the high points where I want like there to be drama and tension. And, you know, it just sort of makes all that, you know, here's the big reveal 45 seconds in at this exact point. And so like build up to that. And then it will kind of, you know, crescendo the whole thing. It's incredible. So these are just tools. It's a tool, like a computer was a tool, like, you know, everything was a tool, everything is a tool. And it's a great tool to have in the toolbox. And I think it's going to unleash a lot of imagination and allow people to do things they simply could only think about, but now they can actually do. And those who can also do it personally, like if you can actually paint, great. That's great too. Like, that'll be a different version of art, you know, and there'll be generative art and real art and, well, not real art, it's all art, but generative art and handmade art and who knows, but it's a new category and it's fascinating. What's your take? I mean, what do you think?
I think the role of the editor is going to be more important than ever because there's that, I don't know, that natural sense of taste you get. Like you want a certain feel, you want to strike a certain emotion, you know, like that's going to become the true skill. Or, and on the flip side, detecting synthetic media. Like there's, already training in Finland, I think, it's a national effort where they're teaching kids how to look at fake news and disinformation, basically, and say, you know, okay, so that, I don't know, the one on of Trump being arrested last week, the fake images comes to mind, right? Like, okay, let's interrogate that. That's clearly fake, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, that's,
but I think,
but figuring out how to know, how to like detect that was fake. Like, what are the tells? This is going to be a skill. I think you're right, though, about editing especially. It's no different than directing. You know, if you think about directors who direct movies, there's billion, well, okay, I'm over-exaggerating. There's let's call it thousands probably of outstanding screenplays and scripts. There's unlimited number of wonderful ideas. And there's probably a handful of really damn good directors who can bring that to life in a way. And that's directing. It's kind of, I mean, of course, it's not quite the same, but in some ways it is. You're directing this AI to produce an effect in a certain style, in a certain way. and with certain subtleties that only certain people are going to be able to describe in the same way a great director might be able to pull off a great scene with just the right lighting and just the right FX and just the right facial expressions. It's all those things. So I think it's to think about it more in terms of directing. Directing is clearly hard because there's an unlimited number of ideas and actors prepared to act, but to pull off a great, or a cinematographer, like every movie would be just incredible if it was easy, you know? So I think the same thing's going to be true here.
Yeah. And everyone pulls in their own influences and their own, you know, impulses. And that's the unique part, right?
Yeah.
It's just a matter of getting it done. So I know we're at time and I just got one more question for
you. Of course.
Just kind of a big one. What's the most ridiculous thing you want to do that you don't think you ever will?
Ridiculous thing.
Or improbable. We could go that route too.
I would love to do a 3-month silent retreat. It'd be incredibly hard, but I kind of would love to do it. And in my life right now, I just simply cannot see how that could ever happen until like my kids are out of the house. But then like, well, I want to do it then. So that's the thing about like wanting to do certain things. I want to do certain things for who I am today. Yet, like, let's call it 10, 12, 13, 14, 15 years, whatever it is. Like, well, I want to do that then. I don't know. But right now, that would be an amazing thing to do. And it would basically be completely impossible for me to pull off. I've got kids, I've got married, I've got a company, all the things. I just can't do that. But I would love to see what that would be like.
But there's a part of you now that craves that, right?
Yeah, a big part of me now craves that for a variety of different reasons. And I'm curious about it from a bunch of different perspectives. But there's no way. So the real question is, will there be a way? Because there's always a way, but will there be a will when I have the time or the will or the way to do it? So that's what I'm sort of curious about. Do you have one? I'm sure you've asked people this all the time. I don't know, but
it's the first time I've asked it actually.
Okay.
The first thing that comes to mind is I love heavy metal, and you know, it's like one of my people think it's a weird quirk because I'm just not. I don't know. I guess I'm not the personality for it, but I would love to perform with Metallica at some point, but I don't think it'll ever happen. Yeah.
what do you play?
Guitar. I've got, got a couple electrics here.
Have you tried to make that happen somehow?
I am trying to put pieces in place right now to make that happen.
Okay. That's cool.
So it's not impossible, right? But
what's interesting about things like that is like, it's not fully, obviously it's not completely in your control. There's like, there's some things that are, and then there's also timing and in situations where like, how would you pull it off? And then also like Metallica as a band won't be around forever. So you've got that time scale. It's pretty interesting. That'd be incredible.
Yeah. And then the question is, what do you play with them? Do you get to choose, you know, all these things, you know, and so.
Right.
Do you practice some songs? No, you don't want to play in your Sandman because everyone asks about that, you know, so.
Would this be on stage or would it be like privately, like a jam session?
I think it would be way cooler in private.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think easier, obviously, too. Yeah, I think for sure. To pull that off somehow. Yeah.
You know, because they'll pull people up on stage there they used to back in the day. But they've got an HQ in Marin County where it's all their gear and stuff and they're recording. So that's mine.
Well, you have to be a roadie then. Be a roadie. Work your way up that way. Get in that
way. You know. Who knows? Yeah. Just live on the road, man.
Yeah. Exciting. Well, that's a great one. Good question too, by the way.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Cool.
Well, thank you for everything. Good to talk to you.
This is fun. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Take care.
You too. Don't miss out on future episodes. Get alerts for new drops at subscriptionheroes.co or follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Special thanks to Churnkey for sponsoring the show. Learn how to make customers happier while boosting revenue at churnkey.co. Your support for this show has been incredible so far, and let's keep the momentum going. We are all slaves to the algorithm. Ratings and reviews really do help. Please rate us 5 stars on your platform of choice. We'll be truly grateful. That's all for now. I'm Scott Hirsch, and this has been Subscription Heroes.